The Middle East is a mess. Millions are without food, shelter, and medical supplies. Millions more have been forced to flee their homes. Aid organisations are overwhelmed. Israel has now banned some of the world's most respected aid agencies from working in Gaza and on the West Bank. In the wake of the renewed military action against Iran, 15 of Australia's leading charities have united to raise millions of dollars more in aid for people in Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, and the West Bank, who are now facing an escalating humanitarian crisis. Today, two of the CEOs of those organisations join me. Suzanne Legina is CEO of Plan International Australia, a role she's been in for some 15 years. And Matt Tinkler heads up Save the Children here in Australia, and he also sits on their Global Management Committee, overseeing programs in 120 countries. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Matt, what kind of aid is needed right now?
Oh, look, it's everything from the very basics in terms of food and shelter, water and sanitation, you know, the basic necessities for people to survive, right through to psychosocial support for children and families who've been traumatised, education so children don't miss out on their school, you know, everything that you need to survive and thrive as a child or as a community member has been ripped away from people in this kind of setting at the moment. So there's a huge need in the region, and it's only getting more urgent, unfortunately.
How has it changed or expanded?
Well, it's good to think of an example like Lebanon, I think. So Lebanon, it's an extraordinary country, and it's been through a lot in the last 15 or 20 years, right? So one, it's bordering Syria. It's hosted millions of refugees from that country over the last 10 or 15 years. It's been through an extraordinary inflation crisis where its currency was completely devalued. Then it went through this huge port blast in Beirut. Who could forget that a few years ago? So after it goes from crisis to crisis, then you have this military incursion by the government of Israel into Lebanon. Lebanon's population is about 5.5 million people, and about 20% of that population has been displaced, from an already fragile context. So, you know, I live in the west of Melbourne. If you drew a line from the Maribyrnong River to Werribee and covered all of Melbourne's west and Melton and Bacchus Marsh, that's about the population we're talking about that's been displaced in Lebanon. So just try and imagine that 1.2 million Melburnians coming across the Maribyrnong River into Melbourne City and how our city would cope with that displacement crisis. That's what's happening in Lebanon.
Suzanne, how's the work of Plan been affected by this?
Yeah, it's that general overwhelm, I guess. I mean, Matt's talking about Lebanon there. They're just the people that are registered as displaced. There's also people who are just living with their family or their friends and have moved there who aren't registered, who are being supported. So we are doing everything from, food, shelter. People are living in mosques, churches, schools, on beaches, in cars. They're sharing a toilet between, 50 to 100 people. We've had evidence of women birthing without care, kids out of school. And kids just really anxious. It's a really anxious time. And I think even in Australia, kids are anxious about what they're seeing in the world. But imagine that you were living closer to where the conflict is happening and you've had to just move with whatever you had on your back and you're living in these temporary spaces. That's a lot for a child to have to cope with.
We're hearing all the time about the impact on the oil trade of the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, but it's not just oil, is it?
No, the supply chain constraints are enormous for us. So think about Afghanistan, where there's extraordinary needs for children who are malnourished in that country. We had a shipping crate from Judah depart from India, but the shipping lanes are closed. We're going to have to air freight those supplies to Afghanistan. It's now going to cost us something like $240,000 to freight those life-saving supplies to Afghanistan. And so it's more than the cost of the supplies themselves to freight it there. Same sort of scenario getting humanitarian supplies into Yemen, where we're having to take them over land for the first time instead of via shipping lanes from Dubai. We've heard stories of drivers taking several weeks to transit into Sudan from the port of Sudan due to the difficulty of getting through. So both in terms of delay, cost and complexity, this the procurement and the logistics impacts of this crisis are having a massive impact on the humanitarian system as well.
And Suzanne, there's also the question of fertiliser.
Yeah, so one of the byproducts of the petrochemical process is urea, which is used in fertiliser and is used by subsistence farmers, many of whom are women across the world, to grow the food that they eat. There was an estimate last week from the World Food Programme that, based on the current estimates that they can see, they are imagining major food crises across the Horn of Africa and into Asia next year. Now, famine used to be, in the old days, something that we would talk about once in a 50-year period, and in the last 3 years, we've had the F word, we call it, the famine word, used twice, once in Sudan and another time in Gaza. And it looks like that might be a permanent feature of the current world that we're living in. And the thing about famine is that for children in particular, even small periods of time without sufficient nutrition have lifelong and intergenerational consequences. You never reach your full height. You never reach your full intellectual capability. For girls, their eggs in utero start to be damaged and you have that play out into the next generation. So the problem here is not the shortage of food, because there's enough food to go around, but it is really around how can we really double down on these diplomatic efforts to create humanitarian corridors for us to be able to do our work, which is the work of humans helping other humans in great need.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Suzanne Lagina and Matt Tinkler about getting aid into the Middle East. Matt, let's talk about the situation in Gaza on the West Bank. Why has Israel forbidden Save the Children to work there?
Yeah, so what's happened in the last 12 months or so is that the government of Israel, which controls access to Gaza, has restricted or withdrawn registration from a number of humanitarian organisations, and Save the Children is just one of those. It's done that for reasons it believes relate to its ability to verify key personnel in our organisations and others to their satisfaction.
Why do they have to do that?
Well, look, this goes to the government of Israel's view of the affiliation of staff within humanitarian and UN organisations. So we've seen this play out with UNRWA in Gaza, where it's taken, the government of Israel has taken a hostile view to UNRWA based on its perceptions of, the personnel and their association with the governing authority in Gaza.
What sort of association are we talking about here?
Well, look...
are we talking about active terrorist use of the structures of charities?
Certainly not. And I know for Save the Children, our workforce is heavily vetted. We stand by and can attest to the bona fides of our personnel. We have hundreds of staff in Gaza, Palestinian staff, and they have lived through this conflict for 2 years. They've suffered immensely personally. We've had a number of staff killed. But this goes to the government of Israel's tendency to want to control who works in Gaza. And it is a problem. It's not insurmountable. So, we are registered in Palestine. We have Palestinian staff. They continue to operate in Gaza. They continue to distribute food and supplies, provide psychosocial support, medical assistance, run schools, and those kind of things. So the registration's a problem, but it doesn't completely prevent us from operating in those contexts. But yeah, what we would say is we need more support, not less, in those contexts right now. So anything that governments do to restrict that is a step backwards.
What other organisations have been limited in this way by Israel?
There's a range of other humanitarian and development organisations. Most of the usual suspects in terms of international NGOs have had a presence in Gaza and have encountered these kind of challenges or restrictions with their registration. Save the Children has appealed. It's the ruling by the government of Israel, which is still working its way through the judicial system. So it may be overturned. But as I said, we continue to operate, continue to deliver life-saving aid, notwithstanding some of those limitations.
I've read somewhere that the government of Israel is worried that aid you take in will fall into the hands of Hamas. Do you deliver aid to Hamas?
No, and if you think about many of the humanitarian settings around the world, be it in Yemen or Afghanistan or Myanmar or Sudan or Gaza, often aid organisations have to work alongside governing regimes that other countries don't like. And in some cases, those countries list those under their terrorism laws and other things. But our organisations have fundamental humanitarian principles that they adhere to at all times. These are principles of neutrality, impartiality, independence. We cannot operate in those contexts without those principles. That's what gives us our license to operate and gives us the trust and ability to work with populations and ethnic groups and religious groups of all persuasions. So our organisations take those responsibilities incredibly seriously. We have extremely sophisticated vetting processes and control systems to ensure that every dollar we send to the region goes where it's needed most, and that is to support children and their families to cope with the terrible impact of these conflict. So we can, you know, we have to validate that there is no diversion going on in these contexts because it's our core business to deliver aid where it's needed most. And if anything goes missing, then that's a massive problem for us because it's not having the impact that our donors expect.
But nothing you do is impressing the Israeli government sufficiently to allow you to continue to work there.
No, and I don't think any amount of our you know, evidence of our controls and our systems and processes is going to convince the government of Israel here. I think they've taken a view that they want less agencies operating in that context, not more.
And less aid going in.
Well, unfortunately, that is the consequence, and we've seen that even in the last few weeks in Gaza, the escalation of the conflict in the region resulted in the government of Israel closing the Rafah border crossing once again, one of the lifelines into Gaza where significant supplies can get through, where children were coming out to get a life-saving medical treatment in Israel. It's reopened briefly again, but the amount of aid and supplies getting through and the amount of people getting out for medical treatment is just a drop in the ocean of what's needed. So essentially the blockade was resumed by the government of Israel, which meant, you know, an extraordinarily drastic humanitarian situation only got worse again in the last few weeks in Gaza.
Suzanne, given how much worse things have become in the last few weeks, what's been the response of the Australian government?
The Australian government made an announcement on Sunday for $5 million to Lebanon, and which we really welcomed. There's obviously more that needs to be done, and we're in constant conversation with them about how that might play out. And we've also gone to appeal together as these 15 different agencies to appeal to the Australian people too, to see if they can also dig deep and add to what we can do together to be able to support the need that exists. I mean, 2 weeks ago, you might not have even heard of the Strait of Hormuz, and we know now that our economies and supply chains are absolutely entwined. What we would say is our families and communities are entwined too, and many people in Australia have connections to that region, have family or have come from that region. And at this time, I mean, it's really hard to get this sort of human story of this conflict in the media, to be honest, David. You're seeing constant discussion of fuel prices and interest rates and inflation, and then of blasts. And what you're not seeing is, how does that play out for ordinary people? And we know that war is never good for children. It's rarely good for civilians in any community. And what we need now is for people in a position to be able to help, to be able to support us, to be able to scale our efforts, to be able to help whomever we can in that context.
In just looking at government contributions at the moment, is Australia being generous in comparison to other countries?
I wouldn't want to make comparisons, but just compared to some of our other countries who have donated, the Europeans have put in a lot more money, as have the UK and Canada. Perhaps they're in a position to do so. I would say that the Australian government has been generous, but there's probably more that they can do. And certainly we continue to talk to them about where they might be able to invest.
Matt, what's the general situation with Australian government aid, humanitarian aid abroad? Is it, you know, rising comfortably? Well, comfortably is not the right word, but is it sort of rising with to meet the challenges of you know, dreadful things happening?
I don't think so. The reality is that we are facing probably the greatest humanitarian need any time since the end of World War II. It's something like 520 million children living in a conflict zone before this conflict kicked off again in the Middle East. And last year we had a huge tectonic shock to the humanitarian and development system when the US government essentially withdrew its entire aid funding envelope overnight, which was about a quarter of the global aid and humanitarian funding portfolio. So at a time of drastic humanitarian need, unfortunately, it's coinciding with a shrinking humanitarian budget. In Australia, we spend about $5 billion on aid and development each year. It's about 0.6% of our national government expenditure each year, so a tiny fraction of what we spend each year as an Australian government. The humanitarian portion of that is smaller still. There's a humanitarian emergency fund that's about $150 million annually that the government allocates to these kind of emergency scenarios. The government has contributed here, as Suzanne said, $5 million to the most recent escalation in hostilities. We think they can do more. We think the government needs to allocate more funding overall to its aid and development portfolio. It's certainly not growing at a rate consistent with things like defence expenditure. And, you know, you saw reports over the weekend of the US government going to Congress seeking approval for $200 billion of additional expenditure on war. So the amount we are spending to avoid war and recover from war and build peace is just a fraction of what we are spending on war. And I just think we need to get our priorities right here and globally if we're ever to get to a point in the world where we are living in relative peace and harmony.
Suzanne, I understand that there are particular difficulties in southern Lebanon and will be presumably somewhere down the track in Iran because the Australian government has declared Hezbollah a terrorist organisation.
Yes, this is a bit like what Matt was talking to you about before. It does make some of our work more difficult in those contexts. But as he said before, as receivers of Australian government money, we're required to be and abide by very strict laws of anti-terrorism, money laundering, anti-fraud. We must run the names of all of our partner organisations through specific lists and databases. We take all the precautions that we can. And look, many of us have worked in Lebanon for 15 years without issue. And in some of these places where Hezbollah has been working, and again, we've been able to manage that risk very effectively. And I guess what we'd be saying is there are some problems for us in the way the law is constructed in Australia for humanitarian exemption, and that's something we've been working with the government on and that they have shown a willingness to take action on. But until that's sorted out, we continue just to manage the risk in the best way we know how, which is the way we've been doing it for the last 15, 20 years, abiding by all the laws we've been given.
And Matt, what about the physical risks to your people on the ground?
Yeah, they're significant. As I mentioned earlier, the way most aid and development organisations operate in contemporary days is through national staff. So be it in Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or Gaza, most of our agencies are largely, you know, 95% if not more staffed by nationals. So these are people who are both responding to the humanitarian emergency and living with its consequences every day. So our staff in Gaza, we touched on before, who are trying to support children with their immense needs in the conflict, but their own families are being displaced constantly as the military escalation occurs. Their own livelihoods have been disrupted. You know, the supply of food and support has been difficult for them as well. So it's been an extraordinary couple of years in the lifespan of our organisations, trying to manage both our humanitarian instinct and intent as individuals and organisations, but also the well-being and safety of our staff. We've had a number of staff killed in Gaza in the last few years and their families. The Australian government has sponsored in the last 12 months an important declaration for the protection of humanitarian personnel in these kind of settings to try and send a signal and generate political support to make sure that aid workers aren't a target when we're confronted by these extraordinary conflict and crisis situations.
Has the Israeli government responded to that declaration by Australia?
No, I don't believe they have.
Matt, the West Bank, what's the situation there at the moment? Can help be got to the people of the West Bank?
Yeah, look, it certainly can. Save the Children has an office based in the West Bank. That's where most of our personnel outside Gaza in the region reside at the moment. There is plenty of support that's available in that part of Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. It's subject to the constraints in the global supply chain that I mentioned earlier. So if things were peaceful and if conflict wasn't prevalent in the region, we would be getting more supplies and probably more personnel in to scale up our response. But, you know, there are so many things that our teams can do on the ground to provide relief and support, be it that psychosocial first aid to children and families, you know, maintaining informal education and school systems, providing maternal child health support for pregnant mums, through to the provision of things like cash to make sure that people are able to procure whatever supplies they can to make sure that they can, you know, meet the needs of their family day to day.
So money donated here in Australia is going to get through.
Oh, 100%. We can guarantee that. We've been raising money for the conflict in Gaza since day one. And Australians have been very generous over the last couple of years. So all of that money goes straight to the region, straight to those who need it most. And as Suzanne explained before, there are a lot of systems and controls, checks and balances to make sure that, we account for every dollar that's spent in these kind of settings.
Suzanne, I'm not sure if this is a question for you, but I'm curious about this, that the countries of the Gulf are very prosperous little nations, very prosperous. Do they need aid?
No, they haven't asked for aid. And it's interesting, when Australians were stranded as a result of this most recent conflict, you would have seen the UAE offering accommodation and support to Australians. But what we do is we only support those countries when, you know, if they need help, they will register that they want international assistance. Many of those countries are very wealthy and they haven't asked for that support at this stage.
Right. So the concentration here is on those countries around Israel. So Lebanon, Gaza, West Bank, in the immediate context of the war.
Yeah.
But how much of the aid that you would like to get through is getting through? I mean, do you have some sort of sense, either of you, Suzanne or Matt, of how much is being held back?
Yeah, look, I think I don't want to give listeners the impression that if they donate money, it's not going to make a difference, because it absolutely will. All of our agencies are operating, you know, this is our core job essentially, is finding ways to deliver aid in the toughest of circumstances. And, you know, that's happening in Myanmar right now amidst a civil war. It's happening in Afghanistan under the Taliban rule. It's happening in Sudan amidst that heavy conflict as well. So this is what our organisations do. They find a way to deliver aid in tough circumstances. So it would be better if there were less barriers to do that. You know, we talked about the Rafah crossing in Gaza so we could get more supplies through. But unfortunately, the reality is the humanitarian response in this region is woefully underfunded. So if we raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the next 24 hours, we could spend all of that in a heartbeat and still not have enough to meet the immediate life-saving needs, despite the barriers that are in place. So aid is getting through. We'd like it to get through faster and in a more fulsome way, but it's definitely getting through, and every dollar that people can spare is going to make a difference.
Matt and Suzanne, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Suzanne Legina, CEO of Plan International Australia, and Matt Tinkler, CEO of Save the Children Australia. And if what we've been discussing encourages you to donate, you can by going to Emergency Action, that's one word, emergencyaction.org.au/Middle East Appeal. Or you can call 1300 939 000. This is Late Night Live.